Welcome back to the Intellectual Explorers podcast. Today I'm exploring with Brad Blanton. Brad is an author, psychotherapist, and creator of the Radical Honesty Modality. He wrote 8 books, including his famous book, Radical Honesty. And as I mentioned in my talk with Brad, I read this book when I was 17 or 18, and it had a transformative impact on me. My proclivity and desire to be truthful started after I read this book. I like this constant process of mapping your words to what Brad calls the awareness continuum, which has 3 components: noticing, or what I like to call reporting, on your external surroundings, noticing or reporting on your internal sensations, and lastly, noticing or reporting on the content in your mind. The latter can become problematic when you stop reporting it and start advocating for it, as we see with our current culture war. Honesty and truthfulness have been an ongoing theme of this podcast. I explored this with Kaveh Zahedi, Chester Brown, and most recently with Daniel Thornton. There is something here that's potent. This ability to risk being honest with yourself and others is the basis of good philosophizing. All right, if you have any questions or comments about this episode or podcast, you can tweet me at Peter N. Lindbergh. All right, enjoy this exploration I had with Brad. Today, I'm exploring with Brad Blanton. Before we begin, I'm going to anchor myself in an exploratory mindset. My intention is to engage in this dialogue with a spirit of exploration. I'm not here to agree or disagree, but to be a performative agnostic and understand my interlocutor's map of reality and possibly explore new territory together. That being said, Brad, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
So, when I was a teenager, maybe somewhere between 17 to 19 years old, I read your book, Radical Honesty, and it had a transformative effect on me. Before that, like, I used to tell like white lies or just lie about silly things. For example, like, I remember when I was a teenager, all the cool kids got their driver's license, and I had anxiety about driving at that time. So I just lied about having my driver's license so people wouldn't call me a loser or whatever. It's just like stupid stuff like that I used to lie about. Uh-huh. And after I read your book, I can't remember when I was 17 or 18, I just started radically telling the truth. I just pulled that Band-Aid off, and it felt so liberating. And of course, there was awkward moments, obviously. Like, I said things that maybe I shouldn't have said or didn't need to be said. But thanks to your book, I seriously started building up my truthfulness muscle. So I just wanted to start off and just thank you for that and writing this book.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have done it. That's why I wrote the book.
And so I was wondering if we could start with maybe like an elevator pitch on what radical honesty is, like just a one-on-one version of people who haven't heard it before.
Well, it's basically describing what you notice. The distinction that's critical at the beginning is to know the difference between noticing and thinking. That basically, when you say what you notice, the whole awareness continuum can be easily divided into 3 parts. You can be aware of what's going on outside of you right now. You can see and hear things outside of you right now. That's one aspect of the awareness continuum. The second aspect is you can notice what's going on within the confines of your own skin right now. And then the third is you can notice what's going through your mind right now. So I call it inside, outside, upside down. Is what you observe inside and outside is more reliable because your mind is a very unreliable instrument. And for that reason, we greatly need each other's honesty, because mostly we're wandering around here delusional. And most of our behavior in the world is deluded behavior because we're following some kind of bullshit system or another that we happen to have in mind. So this is a very, I write books for a living. This is an anti-intellectual position where I think a mind is a fine thing if you treat it like a toy. But to make your mind something more than a toy is a big mistake. So radical honesty is about saying what you notice right now in your mind, what you notice right now about the other person you're talking to or outside of you, and what you notice right now within the confines of your own skin. And if you're willing to be present to that and share that, there is a level of intimacy and communication and clarity that occurs so that we end up having what Tom Attlee, my friend, calls cohorted, cooperative, co-intelligent behavior. Mm-hmm. And that intimate, cohorted, co-intelligent behavior is what either will save humankind or end it. The degree to which we do that in the next, say, 12 years is probably critical for the future of the survival of human beings. Because most of us are completely batshit crazy. And most people, even in groups, are crazy. And it's like, I used to work many years ago. I worked on the night shift in a mental hospital as an attendant. And I would be on the back wards from 11 at night till 7 in the morning, keeping an eye on everybody who's supposed to be sleeping. And there were two old men who would sit in the top bunk together and have an animated conversation. One of them spoke Czech and the other one spoke German. Neither of them spoke English or any other language. And they had these animated conversations and laughed and talked and carried on for like 45 minutes or an hour. And then they would go back. One would go to his bed. That would be it. I was supposed to break them up, but I would like to having their animated conversation. But that was always for me the model of human communication. People elatedly speaking in a language no one else could understand. And hearing in what was being said back to them some things that were not being said in that other language by the other person. Basically, the likelihood of honest communication is inversely related to how much you happen to be focused on thinking. That makes sense.
Can you repeat that last part?
So the last part is that the more you're trying to defend an idea,
right,
and you're on the trail of making sure that you're proving that you're right and that anyone that contradicts that is wrong, that you have this agenda that is interfering with the rest of your perception of the world and the rest of your conceptions about the world. It's a limitation that is not always your friend. The ability to focus your attention is not just the ability to focus your mind. Often the ability to focus your attention is based on interrupting your mind. So the mind is a relatively useful toy, and that you can have a lot of fun with the mind if you're grounded in your experience, if you're being willing to have the experiences that you have.
Right.
So that's the main introductory element. The thing that I'm working on these days, I've written seven and a half books, Radical Parenting and Practicing Radical Honesty and The Truth Tellers, and lots of stories of people who, what happened to them when they started telling the truth. But basically, all of these are to introduce what I call the process modality. So just to catch up on current events, what I'm interested in now is the process of forgiveness, which requires completing what's been incomplete. In radical honesty, we found that one of the most pernicious forms of lying is simply withholding. It's not saying something that you know or see or feel or think. You just don't mention it. And that holding back is a form of lying in the sense that you're pretending to share when you're not sharing everything. And that's very poisonous. And in international relations, what we consider security to be is secrecy. Secrecy is security. That's what all the current arguments back and forth about Donald Trump are about these days. And so what's happening is, because we advocate sharing honestly, simply because you'll just be stupider from your lies being shared and other people sharing their lies. You're just multiplying the delusional system that you have a mind that's worth paying any attention to at all. And, you know, there was this commercial for the American Negro College Fund where they used to say, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. And I have a section of one of my books entitled, A Mind is a Terrible Thing, Waste It. Because basically the overvaluing of mind is itself a neurosis. Believing, having faith in, trusting your mind is probably a mistake. I say to people often, I don't even trust my own mind. Why in the hell should I trust yours? Minds are not generally very trustworthy instruments. And the sharing that goes on that has to do with descriptive things is much more trustworthy than sharing that has to do with comparisons, evaluations, and assertions of value.
So a few things come to mind is this distinction that I make on the podcast frequently between truth versus truthfulness. And the idea of like truth is that your model of reality is the most accurate and you have arrived at it. Where truthfulness is sort of that process, that awareness spectrum that you talk about, where you're just sort of reporting reality and trying to map it as accurately as you can, but it's that iterative process.
Yeah.
And another thing that comes to mind there is that the Robert Anton Wilson quote is that belief is the death of all intellect. You know, so if you kind of like believe, truly believe that you've arrived at the truth with the capital T, and you're doing yourself sort of, you're doing reality as a service.
Yes, absolutely. That is, you mistake your model for reality itself.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a couple of threads I want to go down with you, but to kind of circle back to the basics of radical honesty and the six core principles that you have for it. We touched on most of them, but I was wondering if we could kind of double click on the first one, which is lying is the primary cause of suffering. So I guess maybe you can unpack that a little bit and maybe kind of explore why you think people lie so much.
Well, we've been taught all of our lives that who we are is our reputation in the eyes of other people. That is, what other people think of us is our identity. We're taught all of our lives to be able to present a good front, to be able to be polite and be well dressed and behave yourself and be an acceptable human being. That's what every mother wants her child to do, and every family wants their children to do. And it's the way that is generally reinforced is by reward punishment systems that basically trigger a resistance, because every time you're made to do something you don't want to do at the moment that you're made to do it, you build inside yourself a resistance to doing it, and a particular kind of resistance to people who tell you that you must do it. So for every should, there is a resistance. For every top dog, there is a bottom dog. And in the models of Gestalt therapy, the top dog, bottom dog game is a big exercise that we use a lot in radical honesty workshops. I designed a 10-day long workshop called The Course in Honesty. But it got varied and twisted and changed around. It basically ended up being an 8-day workshop called The Course in Honesty, How to Get Over Shit and Be Happy. And what we learned in that course was that basically the ability to engage in a process of sharing changed the nature of reality for you, changed the quality of your life. That what really I designed a workshop to try to do, what I was a psychotherapist in Washington, D.C. for over 35 years. And in the course of, I saw more lawyers than any other single. So I naturally became an expert in lying. And I found that when I would coach people to start telling the truth, they would have a harder time for a little while, but then soon after that, they would no longer be depressed, no longer be anxious, could sleep, could have sex, could do things that they weren't able to do because they were tied up in knots before they started being radically honest. So I've been basically trying to do that politically. I've been in the civil rights movement since I was 19 years old. I'll soon be 79 years old. So it's a long time. That basically the work has been to lose my mind and come to my senses and then get my mind back as a toy and then play with it. That those, the process of sharing honestly allows you to transform the kind of experience you're having so that anger becomes love, sadness and depression become joyfulness, and alienation becomes contact, hate becomes love. But it's done through a process that either humankind is going to either learn or we're going to extinguish ourselves, and we haven't got long to learn it. And the process is being willing to share with others as descriptively as possible what you notice in your mind, what you notice in your body, what you notice about the world and about the person you're talking to. And that the degree of honesty in doing that is critical to our survival, because if we're not honest, we can't find our asses with both hands. So that basically we're already completely screwed up by having a mind. And then when you use it to lie, you just create another level of psychosis on top of the one you've already got. So that's, you can see that I'm very cheery person. My cheerful news, I founded a new religion called futilitarianism. And futilitarianism only has two tenets. One is forget it. That's the first tenet. And the second tenet is pygmies are stealing our luggage. It's based on a religious vision I had on drugs one time, that there were pygmies running all over the world with these little suitcases, grabbing money from other suitcases and putting it in theirs. So I went off askance with that. The main point of what I'm trying to say is that you take everything your mind comes up with a grain of salt.
Right.
You have a little mild questioning of everything everyone else's mind comes up with. And what you find is that life turns out to be a lot more informative to you if you're paying attention to the quality of your attention more than the quality of your thinking. That's why I teach people to do a form of meditation called autogenic relaxation, to practice meditation, yoga, things that have to do with attending to the process of being in the body and the world.
You know, I was having a conversation on this podcast with Kaveh Zahedi and Chester Brown. Kaveh is a filmmaker and Chester is a graphic novelist. So they're both artists, and I think they're both fans of yours. And they're both radically honest with their artwork. They both saw sex workers in the past, and they kind of detailed their experience and their struggles with it in their respective pieces and artifacts. Uh-huh. And so they were talking to each other about, you know, radical honesty and the limits of it. And so that's kind of one thing I want to explore with you. Like I remember when I talked about your book, Radical Honesty book, to people in my life, one common reaction was maybe a negative one. They're like, ooh, radical honesty. Why do I want to be radically honest? Like how radical do you have to be? That's sort of the question. And like just the example that pops in my head, if you see someone and then initial thought like, oh, this person is ugly or they have an ugly haircut or whatever, do you just barf that out? You know what I mean? Or
well, I originally published the book as Telling the Truth. It was a hardback book with lots of illustrations in it. It sold okay, but it wasn't that great. And when I modified it and made it into a paperback, I retitled it Radical Honesty. And sales increased tremendously because the distinction, what's radical about honesty is that we're usually systematically dishonest in ways we're not even aware of. We're just automatically trying to play a role in front of an imagined observer that's some conglomerate of previous observers that we've had in our lives before. And so, when you're radically honest, you will say some things that slightly offend other people or hurt their feelings, and I recommend that you do it, but that you stick with them until they get over it. Usually only takes about maybe 60 to 90 seconds for people to get over being mad or hurt. And if you stay with each other on the other side of that is a deeper relationship in which you feel like you can kind of trust this person to give you a straight answer because they're not going to be dancing around or trying to play up to you or kiss your ass for any reason at all. So basically, you have people you can trust because both of you have said things that were not really that polite and phony the way you're supposed to be. And you start valuing the more authentic relationships that you have. So when I did a book tour all over the country, when my book became a bestseller, when Radical Honesty became a bestseller, I would constantly get this question, though. Your wife gets a new dress, she comes in and says, do I look bad in this dress?
Right.
What do you say? And I always say, you should say, yes, you look like a damn whale. Right off. Because that way you violated the taboo, and then she could be angry and hurt and laugh and everything at the same time. Because what happens is, what does she want? She wants you to be a fashion expert, or she wants you to reassure that she thinks she looks fat in it, or what is the deal? So what do you actually want? And the argument about what you want is a really good thing, because most of what people are disappointed about are things that they didn't even ask for. They just wanted someone else to give it to them and were secretly judging it as proof about whether they cared enough. So the secrets that we have for our secret assessments of other people's relationship to us, those don't help. They further alienate. They keep you in this jail of your own judgments. And the mind is more often a jail unless where you're coming from when you're using your mind is a sharing of what you notice. So if you say to someone, I notice what's going on right now in my body is, I notice the pressure on the seat of my pants in the chair. I notice the vibration in my upper body when my voice vibrates. And I notice I'm looking at the screen in front of me with my name on it. And I notice that I'm in between me speaking, I hear you speaking, and I notice that the thoughts that we're talking about have to do with radical honesty. And so you just go on that noticing trail, and what happens is you go into a way of relating to people that's less plotted in advance by your mind.
Right.
Right.
You're always plotting in advance with your mind about what you're going to say next or what you're going to perform or all that. You're generally a little bit distracted from the relating. And the idea is to resolve, there was a dilemma for about 300 years, starting back with Kierkegaard, among existentialist theologians and philosophers. For about 300 years, there was an argument about whether you could separate your being and your doing. The mind was associated with doing, coming up with ideas and making things happen. And finally, Jean-Paul Sartre said, you cannot separate your being. And Camus affirmed it, but it still didn't help. It was still the dilemma. And it was finally only resolved by the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, whose name was Frank Sinatra. Because he said, doobie doobie doo. And you alternate doing and being. Doobie doobie doo is the answer to the good life. It's the chant that leads to enlightenment. Among others. But I like doobie doobie doo, where you can alternate being and doing, noticing and thinking, and you can share what you notice going through your mind as well as share what you notice in your experience in the world and in your body. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book Radical Parenting, was to say to people, you don't have as much to teach your kids as you think. You have to relearn from them what you forgot. Mm-hmm. So you should get up every morning and touch your child's feet and say, yes, guru, what should I do today? And that's the teacher you have before you is probably wiser than the person you are trying to teach that child what you think they need to know.
I like that kind of, you know, the radical honesty lends itself to like the I-thou type relationship.
Uh-huh.
Where it's like if you're not being honest, it's like you're engineering something and then you're transforming it to like an I-it relationship. You're instrumentalizing the person to achieve whatever aim you think you need to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, if you're being radically honest, you're almost skydiving and you don't know where you're going, but you're going there together with reality.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. I like that.
That's a lot of what Paul Tillich said whenever he read I Thou, was that something similar to what you just said. That basically there's a kind of a trust in being present to each other and to the world. That makes you don't have to defensively figure everything out before you say anything about it.
Hmm.
Be a being relating to another being without an agenda, and have an agenda and not have it predominate, and still be the being to being relation is the primary relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, I never really looked at it like that before, how the idea of honesty or truthfulness, like baked into it, is that component of care.
Yes.
Yeah. So one thing I kind of wanted to inquire with you, I had this conversation with Daniel Thornton recently, a friend of mine, we were talking on the podcast, and as you know, when I'm podcasting people, you know, you get into podcasting mode and you're like, it's kind of like a interviewee host type thing. And I don't like it that much. I like the idea of just kind of being raw, right? Just kind of skydiving, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And then he said something interesting. He said that, you know, like he wants that too, but there's limits because he doesn't know who's listening right now. Right. And a lot of people who are listening may have not put in the work that he's put in, right, to his personal development. And they may weaponize his words and use his words to harm him, right? And then the whole thing with the culture war right now and polarization, doesn't matter what side you're on the political spectrum. If, let's just say, if I were speaking honestly about an important topic, a sensitive topic, and we stumble with our words or whatever, people can use that to harm us. So I guess my question is, What do you think about that? If there's any limits, or how do you approach being radically honest in when we're speaking publicly, when anybody can listen, we don't know who that may be.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a real dilemma, and I'm glad you bring it up, and I don't have any bad answers for it. I'm just saying that mostly what gets harmed is your imaginings about yourself. And mostly what gets harmed is people are taking one of your statements or opinions or judgments and using it in a way that you wouldn't.
Right.
But the process modality is one in which you go ahead and have your fight. You go ahead and hurt your feelings and you get hurt the other person's feelings and you cuss each other. The way we have, when I do couples work, where people are raising kids and they have to be able to get mad and get over it, they have to learn forgiveness or they just stay bitter. Most people's relationships are not successful. I mean, my view of relationships is maybe like 12 to 15% of relationships are successful, and the rest of them are gradations of bad. So I don't recommend that you be politic. You know, there's a whole lot of bullshit in the general dilemma world. Like, lucky for me, my book sales have quadrupled the last 2 years because of Donald Trump, because he's such a wonderful poster child for ignorance, stupidity, and and greed and malice and ignorance all combined into one. So it's like this poster child's up there and people are running and buying radical honesty because they think, Jesus, there's got to be some alternative to this crap. I play golf, and I over at the golf course, some of the people I play golf with are Republicans, and we have this sort of jovial mutual hatred where I'll go and say, how can you even say you're Republican without shitting your pants? Or, no, you dumbass. That's what the original conversation line is in those sort of conversations. But we've gotten to where we just don't talk politics, or when we do, we kind of joke about it or give each other a bunch of crap and try to mess up each other's golf game. But the idea is one of jovial, you're such a damn idiot. You're so full of shit. I can't believe you can even say or think such stupidity. But it's jovial to a certain degree. We seldom have taken our nine irons and gone down beside the bank and tried to beat it out at each other. But the quality of connection between us, given that we disagree politically over such important issues, is still there. There's still a quality of connection. And there is still some conversation now and then in between the extremes of our both hateful and joking interactions, where we're still engaging each other as human beings. And that process modality is what I use a lot when I work with couples and families, is that you go ahead and say what you resent. You say, I resent you for saying what you said. And you say what they said, and you get really mad. And you don't avoid being mad. People always say in the political world that diplomacy is the alternative to war. I don't agree. I think diplomacy is the cause of war. I think being diplomatic is what turns me off. Like, I like Barack Obama, but I thought he did a lousy job as president because he didn't have enough balls to say, no, you dumbass. That's stupid, and I'm not fucking cooperating with the idiotic bunch of goddamn Republicans. I'd love to be present and be the left-wing representative of the attitude of Donald Trump. Like, fuck them if they can't take a joke. And there is a certain jovial ability to get mad and get over it, get hurt and get over it. You can get hurt and cry, and it helps. You get mad and cuss, and it helps. And you can be really mad. Somebody's supposed to meet you at 7:30 and they don't show up till 8:20, And you say, I resent you for when you showed up. And they say, well, they have some kind of excuse. And you're still mad. And you say, I resent you for that excuse. I resent you for what you said about it. And I sometimes have people say, I resent you for such and such, and I will never forgive you. Because the assertive statement, I will never forgive you, helps them get to forgiveness. Because there's a certain thing that happens when you're radically honest. When you experience an experience, it comes and goes. But when you resist experiencing an experience, it persists. And so the transition has to be from the experience to the letting go of the experience. But it doesn't work if you avoid the experience. So I recommend that people sit down and tell each other when they're mad at each other exactly what they're mad about, how mad they are, and raise hell and cuss and do everything, and then don't kill each other and don't hit each other, but be as mean as you can be as long as you're adults. Don't be that way with your kids. But the idea is to teach the process of getting mad and getting over it, because forgiveness is a very tough process. And you have to be courageous in order to be a forgiving person. And to authentically forgive takes the courage of authentically sharing what you resent and what you appreciate. Let them increase, then decrease, then recede and fade away. And I recommend the same thing for appreciation as for resentment. You don't want to build it up in some romantic idealism. You don't want to say, oh, you're the most wonderful person in the world I've ever. And what happens there is a kind of disappointment in romance, and you end up in a bad hillbilly song saying, why don't you love me like you used to do? Why do you treat me like a worn out shoe? And all those bad hillbilly songs come out of people denying themselves the possibility of having an experience that they can get over. And once you get over that argument about showing up at 8:20 instead of 7:30, is that eventually you put your arm around each other and say, okay, I'm over it. Let's go get a beer and have a talk. And then you do. But forgiveness is a pragmatic requirement for a good life. You can't live very well without being able to forgive. So politically, it's hard to do. I was interviewed by the Secret Service a few times in my life because I demonstrated against the war in Vietnam, and I was arrested 15 times or so in the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. The Occupy movement, basically, I've been an anti-establishmentarian and stood up for it a lot. And basically, I'm still proud that I've done that, and I try to get arrested every year or so just to keep my mind and heart clean. And I was in the Women's March. I couldn't get them to arrest me. We did all kinds of bad things to these cops, but they wouldn't. I said to him, what do I got to do to get arrested? Hit you? And he said, well, that would do it. But the reason I'm bringing all that up is because the process modality is one in which you intentionally don't stay on point with proving your righteousness. You share also your degree of attachment to being right and your certainty that the other person is an idiot for not agreeing with you, until you can get over that enough to say, well, you're doing the best you can, I'm doing the best I can. Let's get a beer and talk about other things.
Right, right. It's like a couple of things come to mind there. Kaveh, the filmmaker, he said, make honesty your impression. Right? It's like we're talking about impression management and how we all kind of want to like get the best view of ourselves. But if you make the process, the honesty process, your impression, that's sort of like you're always sacrificing your impression.
I like that.
And then the other thing that comes to mind is this distinction I think I learned from acceptance commitment therapy of dirty pain versus clean pain. Like dirty pain is the avoidance of addressing a pain or a painful issue or topic. Uh-huh. And if you don't address it, then it becomes dirty and you let it seethe and all that kind of problematic aspects happen.
Yeah, it's like an infection or a pus in a
zit. Right, right. So, like, another question I had is how do you deal with, like, bullshit, right? Like, and I noticed this is prevalent in people who are committed to, like, a 9-to-5 type lifestyle. They're working in an office environment. There's so much kind of, like, phoniness and fakeness there, I find, right? I could be uncharitable here, but it's like I'm not really connecting with the real person. And if somebody's really good at identify with their career or that kind of path, and it's like that seeps into their personal life too, unless you put some drinks in them.
So a lot of people do drink.
To escape the mask, right? So how do you recommend kind of communicating with individuals that are in that kind of mindset?
Well,
assuming that you're committed to honesty, the process of honesty.
I think what I do is I sort of lovingly joke. I crack a lot of jokes. When people think something, particularly when they think something is sacred or should or should not ever be said or done a certain way, then I try to make a wisecrack about it and see if I can engage them on, is there any chance you could detach from being so attached to your righteousness about this?
Right. So the joke is like an invitation.
The joke is like an invitation. Let's laugh at this instead of act as though it's deadly serious.
Because it's not something sacred. It's I like that. So, maybe the last question I can end off is your workshops. Maybe you can speak a little bit about that and how they're structured and how the transformational process occurs there.
Okay. Well, basically there are a sequence of learnings. You get some distinctions as you go through, but the fundamental distinction we talked about a little bit a while ago, which is the distinction between noticing and thinking. And then there are a lot of paired exercises, processes, and there's a lot of what's called hot seat work, where people come up and work with me and a co-therapist, sit on a seat between us, and the rest of the people in the circle are watching what's going on. But the main interaction is between the two trainers and the person on the hot seat. And that it's called the hot seat because it's like the electric chair. Because you know everybody is looking at you, and you have two therapists looking at you, and we're listening not just to the words you speak, but to the way you speak them, how rapidly you speak them, the tone of voice you use, changes in your tone of voice, how much punctuation of laughter and heavy breathing and various other things occur. We're looking at everything that comes out of you as a communication. If you giggle, if you burp, if you fart, everything's a communication. So you're people get a little nervous because all their lives they've been taught that who they are is the image they make in the minds of other people. Hmm. So we go into that very explicitly. And in the evenings, we have two people get an hour each to tell the whole story of their life, and it's videotaped. And they tell the story of their life, and they get notified every 15 minutes. All right, that's 15 minutes. You have 45 minutes left. That's 30 minutes. You have 30 minutes left. And so that basically at the end of an hour, they've got a life story and it's in tape. And then after the workshop, we ask them to go show that to their parents and to their brothers and sisters, and to their friends, and to their spouses, because it definitely is sharing a lot of things that the people are always surprised about what they learn about people that they know when they come to a workshop. And that level of sharing brings about problems, troubles, conflicts, and love, intimacy that wasn't there before. And the idea is to be able to work through the deeper connection without and finding out that it's not as terrifying as you imagined it would be, that your mind told you it'd be, if you're just open and honest. And that you're not only imperfect, everybody else is imperfect. And that perfection may not be such a wonderful thing after all, that being able to be honestly the imperfect creature that you are might be a better way to live than to constantly be posing as better than someone else. So there's a lot of work like that in there. There's a lot of work in there with couples that come to the workshop, and that they're making the decision about either staying together or separating. And whichever they do, we say that what they need to do is to get to forgiveness with each other before they split up or recommit. That you get to forgiveness by experience, having it increase, decrease, then recede, and then go away. So that you face your experience, you have the experience, you let go of the experience. And that the process then becomes some agreement. So we make people in the workshop an offer to promise us if they want, about completions they will do in their real life. So people make agreements when they leave that workshop to go and talk to their parents or to their exes or to people that they're incomplete with and do a lot of what's called completion work. There are a number of things. We have a lot of movies we show during the workshop. We show videos, we do lots of variety of things that are done. That basically there are themes. There's a theme for each day, but the themes all have to do with get to the place that I thought people got to when they did about a year of psychotherapy when it worked. What worked whenever people who were anxious and couldn't sleep got to where they could sleep and were no longer having that dominate their lives. And people who were depressed, not being depressed anymore. The main thing was that the most powerful thing they could do was to interrupt their patterns of lying and to start being honest. And to work out of honesty is an invitation to the person you're talking to do the same. They think, well, if you can do it, I can do it too. And they do. And it works as an invitation. And so what we're after is that there is a kind of authenticity that comes from vulnerability that's voluntary. You're volunteering to be more vulnerable than you usually were. And in that vulnerability, you discover an appreciation for other people who are also becoming more vulnerable. And you find that not only are you not angry all the time, you're falling in love again. And that love recurs and recedes and comes back and comes forward, and it's a dynamic. And so does anger and all these other so-called emotions. So the general doodling along in the world, but in the direction of being willing to, and even when you're scared, going ahead and doing the sharing and vulnerability that's necessary, allows for an ongoing kind of deeper way of relating to the human beings you're surrounded with in the world.
Right. That sounds like a really lovely process to engage in. Yes. And for the listeners, I highly recommend you check out the book Radical Honesty. And I've read two of your books, Brad. So those are only two I could recommend. Radical Honesty, I think, is the other, your follow-up to it, Practicing Radical Honesty. But yeah, you so check out the rest of Brad's books, check out his workshops. And Brad, is there anything you'd like to leave the listener with?
I would like to say that I think that we are all in a crisis, like, you know, basically the 12 years to do something about global warming is kind of symbolic. I think we have 12 years to do something about honesty in the way we relate to each other in the world and to learn something about the process of getting over things. I've got an online course called Radical Honesty, How to Get Over Shit and Be Happy. And that online course, you can find it radicalhonesty.com, and it'll be launched again in the next couple of months. And what we're trying to do is we have Radical Honesty trainers all over the world. There are about 40 Radical Honesty trainers here and in Europe. We have something like, over the last year, we've done about 80 Radical Honesty workshops in 10 countries in the world and 3 languages. Basically, the trainers are being trained, and we're a cult, and we plan to take over the world. And so I need to confess that, I guess. So that's it. I think that's good enough.
At least you're consistent with the honesty.
That's right.
So I'll include all that in the show notes. So Brad, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. That was great.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. And let me know if I can do any more.
All right, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring.